Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, Michael Lewis out with a brand new book on Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. Doing the circuit, we managed to get him right after his 60 Minutes podcast, and he was completely open and unguarded and talked about everything. Talked about the process of writing the book, what it's like to go on 60 Minutes, and know that social media is going to come at you. People would much rather go to the outrage machine than actually learn the details and argue from a factual perspective. He doesn't have an opinion on whether or not Sam Bankman-Fried is going to be found guilty or not. And the book is similar. He just lays it out as he saw it, as a fly on the wall, and lets you, the reader, figure it out. So all of you haters out there, he's just shaking it off and moving on with whatever is going to be his next book project. I found the book to be absolutely fascinating. Really enjoyed it, although I read it, you know, quickly in a weekend. Normally I luxuriate in Michael Lewis, and I found our conversation to be completely delightful. And I think you will also. So with no further ado, my discussion on going infinite with Michael Lewis.
It's good to see you, Barry.
Good to see you again. So let's start out talking about how this landed in your lap. A friend is thinking about doing a deal with FTX, and he contacts you, says, I can't get a read on this guy, Sam Bankman-Fried. Tell us about that first meeting with SBF. What was that like?
So this friend reaches out in September of 2021. And I never heard of Sam Bankman-Fried or FTX. I hadn't been paying much attention to crypto. And Sam Bankman-Fried, a few weeks later, ends up on my front porch, and I take him for a hike in the hills of Berkeley. I think it's the first hike he ever went on. That he was always dressed for the hike, but never actually goes.
Sneakers,
on.
Cargo shorts,
yeah,
T-shirt.
I had no idea what was going to turn up, and what turned up was this kind of kid. He's 29 years old. So I wasn't thinking this is literary material. I was thinking my friend wants to know what I think of this guy. But an hour into the walk, after I've discovered that Forbes has decided he's worth $22.5 billion, he's kind of bemused by his whole situation. It's gone from zero. This has happened in 18 months. He's gone from zero to $22.5 billion in 18 months. And he's describing what is going on in crypto, where he intends to use this money, kind of his background, where he came from. He's this child of these two Stanford academics. His parents were just completely bewildered by what had happened to their child because they weren't money people. They weren't materialistic people. They were people who just kind of lived in their heads. And he said they don't quite understand what to make of all this. And I thought it was kind of funny. So I called my friend at the end of it. I said, go ahead, do the deal. What could go wrong? And he did the deal. But I turned to Sam Bankman-Fried at the end of it, and I said, I don't know where this is going to end, but I just want to watch. Can I just tag along?
Like that first meeting, you actually set this up. He was that fascinating.
He was that fascinating. And I know this because I gave some interview right after this, and someone said, do you know what your next book project might be? And I said, you know, I just had a two-hour walk with a guy, and I think I might have found it. But I didn't know what the book was. I didn't know much more about him than you can learn in 2 hours. I just knew I had a theory about how I wanted my next book to work. Before COVID, I don't want to bore you with this, but before COVID, I had made a decision that I wanted to walk into books with characters, that I wasn't gonna know what the story was. I wasn't gonna have a theory of the case. I wasn't gonna have an argument. I was gonna attach myself to characters who interested me.
As opposed to prior books, where there's a narrative and the characters flesh it out.
Well,
you're inverting it.
I'd always kind of done this. I was just making a bigger point of it. And my prior books that I felt that were less fun to write were books where I had to strain to make the characters, like to make them live on the page.
Because I find all your characters leap off the page. Or maybe that's just...
I think that there is a weakness, for example, to Flash Boys in the character of Brad Katsuyama because he's...
Well, that's
because
he's a chill dude.
Precisely.
You know, he's a laid-back
guy. He's a simply nice, decent guy.
Right.
That he's very... I love him.
But he's doing something really different.
So it works only because when you drop that character into the middle of modern Wall Street, it gets very interesting.
He's very Canadian.
Right?
And that doesn't come
nice
across.
Nice Canadian guy is not where I wanted to ever start again. And I wanted to start with complicated, interesting people. And I had an idea. My idea was Mike Leach, coach of the Mississippi State Bulldogs at the time, mm-hmm. was going to let me move into his life for a season in SEC football.
That could have been fun.
So it's character and situation. College football is in turmoil because of name, image, and likeness stuff, the transfer portal. It's becoming ever more professionalized. The schools are an afterthought. You know, they're sort of like you have the school to have a football team. And Mike Leach, who I'd written about once, is a delightful character who would provide a view on it that would be so good. He died. That's what I would have done if he had lived.
You could have found some other coach to track, though, if you really wanted to go that route.
But you'd need to find a coach who you really could light up on the page.
Okay.
And who would let you in. So who would let me see everything. And Mike Leach, I knew, would let me see everything.
And he's quite a character.
Oh, my God. Yes. So anyway, so I had that in mind when I met Sam. I thought the character in the situation, he's like walking social satire. He acquired $22.5 billion in a flash, and the world was reorganizing itself around him.
Everybody wanted something. By the way, the 22.5, and I don't know if this is from the book or my research, Forbes settled on that number. They suspected it could have been as high as $100 billion, but they just couldn't come up with ways of showing.
How do you value piles of serum in Solana and FTT and who knows what the hell's inside of Alameda Research?
Right, which raises an interesting question. Once you decide to write this, you have to know you're going to be discussing crypto. But before you began work on Going Infinite, did you have any thoughts on Bitcoin, blockchain, NFTs, Ether? Like, what were you thinking about prior?
So going back to about, I don't know, maybe 2012, I had made several runs at writing about crypto, mainly at the behest of crypto people because mm-hmm. they wanted attention. And, I mean, the first one was funny.
I hadn't noticed that.
I never wrote it.
Oh, okay.
I went and spent time and interviewed people, and I just thought...
So you never put anything... So you had some rudimentary sense.
The first time I make some bid to get to know the people and to write a story about it, a guy called me up from Palo Alto. He had a legitimate crypto business. He said, if you come down, there's some people... Just come down in the next few days to this house. There's some people I want you to meet, and one of them is Satoshi. And I fell for it. You know, I thought.
So yeah, I was gonna say that's too much, right?
Well, but you know, it was 2012, so maybe Satoshi's gonna reveal himself to me.
Right. Early.
And so I went down and I got out of the car about a block from the house, and you could smell the weed from a block from the house. And I got in the house, and there were like 12 entrepreneurs with sleeping bags crashing in this multi-million-dollar house in Palo Alto, and some of them turned out to be quite prominent in crypto. Mm-hmm. But the problem was, this is what turned me off. They said at that moment they were selling crypto as it's going to replace fiat currency. It's right. going to be the means of exchange.
And you've talked about how the narrative has changed consistently.
They keep changing
and,
the story.
And just never finds a narrative that sticks.
It's not that there's nothing there. It's just that whatever is there has not clicked with like a serious problem in a serious way. But at that moment, it was, I spend the day with them. And they're selling me as hard as they can sell me that this is going to be, we're not going to need dollars very soon. And I said, but can you use it? And they said, here, we'll show you. And they put some Bitcoin on my phone. And we walked into Palo Alto to the one coffee shop that accepted Bitcoin as currency. Right. And I bought a latte.
Which probably cost you $1 million.
No. This gets better. The coffee shop, though it in theory accepted Bitcoin,
yeah,
it took 10 minutes and they gave up. They right. couldn't do it. And I said, I got an idea. I have this thing called a dollar. I'll just use this. It's a miracle. And I had this thought. I thought, like, they're selling this thing, but if in some wacky world, Bitcoin was the first currency, and then someone came along and invented dollars,
right?
Everywhere they go, thank God,
right?
Right. So I just thought it's not right. There's like there's something to lampoon, but it's I don't want to do that.
It wasn't ready for you to write
about. It wasn't ready for me to write about.
So Sam Bankman-Fried is this fascinating, quirky character. You decide to embed with him like a military journalist embedding with the troops. So while they're covering a war, what was that like? Was it difficult to maintain arm's length objectivity? Because you're a journalist, essentially.
So
and you're like trailing this guy.
Right. So the first thing, I mean, if I had to go back, I had a hard time remembering it, but if I go back and I think, what was it that made me think, not just this character, but this situation, part of it was he wasn't trying to sell me crypto,
right.
That he himself didn't completely swallow crypto, that he wasn't a religionist. He said, basically, I am using it to make money because there are all these inefficiencies. I don't know what's going to happen with it. It was the first crypto person not to pitch crypto to me.
That's really interesting.
And it was interesting. It made him more interesting to me. And it was the first time I thought, this may be the way into crypto. Because to me, what was interesting about crypto at that point was, I mean, the technology is interesting. The whole financial structure that's arisen in crypto, it's interesting. It's not a book by me. What's interesting and is a book by me are the social consequences of all of a sudden there being $3 trillion of new wealth that's just randomly distributed.
It's mostly dudes. It's crypto
that's
bros.
Right. That's right.
And there's a reason why Lamborghini sold out for 2 years.
That's right.
So, it's have fun being poor.
So I didn't answer your question, but this is the why of it. So embedding. I always embed, right? That's what I do. Mm-hmm. The goal is to get to a point with the subject where you're sitting in their office with a desk and they don't even know you're there anymore.
So does that compromise your objectivity as a journalist?
It never has before.
Okay, that's a fair answer.
I mean, nobody's...
Because people are saying, Michael got so close to SBF and he's defending him. I didn't read the book that way. I read it as an explanatory, a defense.
But
that's the accusation.
The radical act was just to tell the story as I saw the story.
Mm-hmm.
What possible purpose, what possible good would it do me to set myself up as Sam Bankman-Fried's defense counsel? And that's not what it was. And in fact, there's all kinds
people ask me, find out what he got paid. I'm like, are you kidding?
So people said this about Flash Boys.
Oh, really?
A Wall Street firm published a note that I had been given shares in IEX to write Flash Boys.
And not true, right?
Of course not true.
And full disclosure, not only did you get a butt ton selling the book, you sold the movie rights before this even came out. Why would anyone else have to pay you for this? Such a silly accusation.
Let's just actually establish the relationship. So, of course, I don't get paid anything. Of course, I didn't have any financial interest in FTX. In fact, I'm a creditor. I have $2,000 on the U.S. exchange that I'm waiting to get out of the bankruptcy.
There you go.
Because I wanted to see how it worked. You know,
right.
Neither Sam Bankman-Fried nor anyone in his operation ever asked me what I was doing, asked me why I was doing it, questioned the questions I was asking, forbid me from seeing. There was only one part of his empire that I had to fight to see. Like he had to say, he said, I can't let you into that meeting because the people are going to be too uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it was just like, it's here. You just watch, you ask, you can ask anybody any question you want to ask. And it took me a while to get to that point, but So they had no finger. As far as I know, they haven't read it. So nobody reads the book until it comes out.
Right.
And that's the deal I've had with everybody I write about. And it's sort of like, at some point, you just have to leave me alone and trust that I'm not some sinister person.
Let me ask you a question that's going to make you feel old. Given how famous you are in Wall Street finance circles from Liar's Poker forward, any of these 20-somethings know who the hell you are?
They all love Flash Boys.
They do? Okay. Yeah. So they had a sense of...
No. They all had books to sign and all
yeah.
that. So the answer is yes. It was odd what they knew.
Sam, not Liar's Poker, not The Big Short, not Moneyball. Those are the big three.
So Sam...
Or The Undoing Project.
Sam never said this, but I found out from his parents that he adored Moneyball when he was a little kid. And
oh,
of course
really?
He did, because he was, he was a totally isolated math geek sitting alone in his room who felt powerless. And all of a sudden this book says the things you can do actually could change baseball. But apart from that, no, I was just the weird old guy, right? That was kind of what it was. They were so odd themselves as a collection of characters. It's the best. Look, FTX, never mind Sam. FTX was the best collection of characters I've seen in a financial operation since Solomon Brothers.
Wow.
Because they were just like, they were all these random people. Like they weren't filtered in the way that a financial firm usually filters people. Mm-hmm. It was like the odd collisions that happened between the world and FTX, and from the world, odd people had entered FTX.
Huh, amazing.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You spend a lot of time talking about what an odd, quirky, sort of socially misfit kid he was. What was the source of that? Was that Sam himself? Was that his parents? Was that other people? How did you paint that picture of a young SBF?
So I think it's partly because of how I grew up and the importance of like who my parents were and who my friends were and who my coach was. When I'm trying to get to know somebody, I go right to the childhood.
Right.
And sometimes that's a mislead that doesn't lead you anywhere. So Sam, I asked him, I'd like just a list of people who knew you before the age of 18 who could give me some picture of you just to start out, right? And he said that there's nobody. I said, what do you mean there's nobody?
It's the guy he played the game with.
I pushed and pushed. And finally, the list is his parents who you know, they did observe him. And his little brother who says, I didn't know him. Mm-hmm. And he was a tenant in the house, his little brother said. And there was one guy named Matt Nass who Sam met in middle school and he became partners in this game they played called Magic the Gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt Nass's chief attribute was he made no emotional demands on Sam, and they seemed to hardly talk. They just sat there and played together. And you see them together now, and they still will sit together and not hardly talk. So there was, it was that, and Matt would say, you know, they were, Sam, they weren't that close in some ways. They were close, they're close playing games together. Mm-hmm. So you had this kid who was, he was totally isolated. You can imagine if other circumstances, a child might end up being very isolated, but he is the child of two very social professors living on the Stanford right. campus who have a world around them of really smart and interesting people. And Sam is known by nobody. And so the question is why? He still has horrible problems with social interactions. Mm-hmm. But when he's a kid, he realized, for example, that he didn't know how to make facial expressions.
Right. He teaches himself to smile and finds out that solves a problem within the game that is the simulation of life.
That's exactly right. He sits in front of a mirror, but it's not till college, and learns to make the facial expressions that are appropriate to what someone says. But he's irritated that he has to do it. He realizes he doesn't have a full complement of human feeling, that he doesn't feel happiness. He doesn't feel pleasure, really. He doesn't feel empathy. And that this is, you know, it's just like, he realizes the people around him see him as not completely human.
So I have a question that I was going to ask you later on, but I might as well bring it up here. So it's already come out. He's being treated with the MSAM patch for Adderall and Adderall for ADHD and depression. The persona in the book that you just described kind of reminded me a little bit of the reference you make in The Big Short to Michael Burry, who, when he finds out his son has Asperger's, has himself tested, and he's on Asperger's. So the obvious question is, I have seen no mention of this anywhere. Sam on the autism/Asperger's spectrum?
Whatever it is that he's diagnosable with is so much more extreme than Michael Burry.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And it's, I don't know. So I don't use any of those words in the book.
I noticed that, which is what made me ask the question. By the way, nobody has brought that up anywhere in any interview. I found something buried in a Reddit where someone brought it up. But other than that, because I was hunting to see, hey, this guy, I'm not a diagnostician, but I've read enough about this. I've worked with enough of those folks. I've had enough people with Asperger's on the show.
You know, the word that, it's funny, whatever word you would use would put him in a box that probably he doesn't belong in, because it feels different from what I've seen before.
Okay.
Of those, and I tell you, it seems different. He's very, very good at reading you.
Which people on the spectrum generally are not.
So there's this odd one-way thing. He reads you very well, but he's hard to read as a kid. So the other thing about it, the important beats in his childhood, I think, are one, his parents don't think of him as gifted. They worry about him. They think of him, and his parents' friends said to me, they thought the parents were both afraid for and of him, which was a curious thing to say about a parent and a child. And it's not until he's in middle school when his mom finds him sobbing in his room alone, and he says, "I'm just so bored," that she realizes that he's an average student, and he's an average student because whatever's coming out of the teacher's mouth just does not interest him.
He knows it. There's a piece in the book where his mom is going to give a paper somewhere, and like the 8-year-old gives her a read on the paper more sophisticated than the PhD candidates gave her as a critique.
So it was a bit like, He was waiting. He wasn't living his childhood. He was waiting for it to end,
right,
so that he could start talking to people. And in any case, he's eventually identified as gifted mathematically.
Right. So he's brilliant at math. He goes to MIT to study physics and math.
So brilliant, but not that brilliant. So brilliant enough.
Really?
So brilliant enough so that, sure, he goes to math camp in the summer and kind of finds his tribe. But in math camp, he's not the best. He's kind of just average. Among the brilliant math kids, he's average. So he has no sense of himself as special until he collides with Wall Street.
So that's where I was about to go. So he goes from MIT to Jane Street Trading, which is a high-frequency trading shop where it's really partly about math, but mostly about probabilities and problem solving and game playing, where he excels.
And it's sort of quantifying what usually doesn't get quantified. Quantifying things that seem to be sort of subjective. The test that he gets, this is where he finds out, my God, I'm actually off the charts good at this.
Right.
The Jane Street interviews where they're making him do all kinds of weird puzzles and solve puzzles and play games and make bets, that he flies through the thing. And he realizes that what he's good at is not chess he's good at. It's chess where you're on a clock, you have 5 seconds to make the move, and every 5 minutes someone shouts a rule change. So the right. The queen is now a rook. And so it's semi-chaos.
But he can manage that.
He can manage that. It's not that he's better than when he's playing regular chess, it's that everybody else is worse.
That's a quote right from the book. It wasn't that he thrived under pressure, he just didn't feel it. He wasn't better than usual, he just wasn't worse. Most people felt emotions he did not, and therefore performed poorly under pressure.
And you know what I think? I think this is a really important key to everything that happens next in Sam Bankman-Fried's life, because once he discovers that it's this environment, it's sort of this semi-chaotic environment where mathematical aptitude, ability to quantify, ability to make quick judgments about probabilities really benefit you, but there's no clear, perfect right answer. He's so good compared to other people in that environment. He creates that environment over and over and over so he can be the best. I think that's like the beginning of the understanding of Sam Bankman-Fried. He loves that feeling of being the best. Who doesn't? It's a weird environment, and he realizes what it is, so he creates it. Jane Street, the markets create it for him. So right. It's a really good, he's a natural in the markets. But even in his own company, the reason there's chaos in his company, I would tell you there are reasons we don't have job titles and we have no organization chart and there's no list of employees and nobody knows who's supposed to be doing what. But in fact, he wanted everybody to be in the same state of chaos. That's where he won.
Allows him to thrive. I love the story at Jane Street where he figures out that they can scrape each state's presidential election data.
Oh, yeah.
And figures out they get a 5-minute lead on CNN. And they start trading futures overnight in 2016 in the presidential election. They're up $300 million. Tell us what happens.
This is an amazing story.
I love that part.
So there's some scoops in the Jane Street part of the book, I think. I mean, just assembling a portrait of Jane Street is not easy because they just won't talk to you.
Right.
But Sam sort of created the portrait because he hired so many former Jane Street people, and they felt free to talk. But there was the Trump trade. So Sam Bankman-Fried was partly responsible for the worst trade in Jane Street history, as far as he knew.
Which started out as a giant winner.
That's right. And it's if you really think about it, it's a wild trade. So going into the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, it looks like every time there's good news for Trump in the weeks running up to the election, the markets tank. It looks like that's the trade. If you can, the trade is, can you get election information before the rest of the market? Now, it seems like a wild idea. That seems like information that is everybody's going to get basically at the same time. But in fact, where everybody's getting it is from John King on CNN. And John King has commercials, and John King has to walk from getting the data to get to his board. The data is slow to get to John King. So Jane Street creates its own data gathering system in the important states. People took...
Right. It's just Florida and Ohio and Virginia.
And they're sometimes moments and sometimes hours ahead of CNN in knowing what just happened in the election and how the odds just shifted and what John King's going to say next and what that's going to do in it to S&P futures. So their bet they put on, in retrospect, they should have maybe thought more about the bet, but it was good for Trump, short S&Ps in a big way and short in foreign markets like Mexican markets or whatever in a less big way. And during the night, as it progresses, it looks like the genius trade. The markets collapse. Sam Bankman-Fried goes home at 3 a.m. and they're up $300 million. He sleeps for 6 hours and comes back. And the problem is the international markets stayed down, but the U.S. stock market popped back up.
Tax cuts and fiscal stimulus. What's not going to be good for equities?
And so it went from a $300 million win to a $300 million loss.
Biggest in Jane Street history.
So not much of this makes it into the book, but there were these long memos that were written about in Jane Street about the trade.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've got them.
Because there was no postmortem. No one ever pulled him aside and said, hey, you blew us up.
Sam wrote these long memos to his boss about, we need to write long memos about this because we ought to understand what we did because this is a wild opportunity. We got we succeeded. We got the information before anybody else. It wasn't in the market. Nobody else had it. You didn't see the markets move when we got the information. We were the only ones there. So he describes how they should have thought about the trade, and what they should have done is they should have shorted international markets. And maybe even hedged it against with U.S. markets. That's his view. But he can't get his superiors to engage. They just like think, as he put it, that we just shouldn't be doing this. Like, this is not our wheelhouse. And it disappointed him. I mean, I think he thought...
Set the grounds for him to exit.
It was one of several things. But yes, which is... And if you think about this, you got to kind of love Jane Street. That in my day, if someone had done this, there would have been a scapeoat.
Oh, absolutely.
Someone would have been strung up.
There would have been a committee. There would have been a review. Someone would have been fired. Tarred and feathered, drummed out of Wall Street.
This is a very smart place because the process was right. The outcome was a problem. Mm-hmm. The process was mostly right. And it wasn't
No second level thinking. They didn't stop and say, all right, so what happens if he's elected?
That's right. And but that they don't go punish Sam and the handful of people who are really at the center of it. If I were Sam, it would cause me to love my employer.
For sure.
Right? It'd be a reason to stay. And for him, it becomes a reason to leave. And that's our part of a reason to leave. That's curious.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So let's talk a little bit about Alameda Research and FTX. Alameda predates FTX. It's the sort of hedge fund trading operation that Sam Bankman-Fried is operating under, and it begins arbitraging crypto between like Asia and the United States and making a ton of money in what should be something that in the equity markets, there wouldn't be that big a gap. Tell us about that.
So the basic idea, he's sitting at Jane Street and his financial ambition is limitless, not because he wants to buy a yacht, but because he wants to save humanity from existential risk. But never mind that for a minute. He looks at the crypto markets, and this is late 2017. And they're exploded, right, that year. And it's a $1 trillion market. And the Jane Streets of the world, which are engaged in this sort of radical efficiency inside of financial markets, like efficient to a microsecond.
But heavily regulated.
But that getting information into the markets as fast as information can be gotten into the markets, that isn't happening in crypto. It's not happening to the extent that a Bitcoin is trading for 1,000 in Japan and 800 in the United States.
And literally, that's the gap.
Yeah,
it's giant.
It's huge. Sometimes
it would be 20 cents in equities, and it's $200.
That's right. Sam looks at that and says, I can be Jane Street for crypto. But then it becomes high comedy because he's doing it on behalf of his movement, Effective Altruism. And his idea of starting it is to start it with a bunch of effective altruists in Berkeley, where there's money from effective altruists to supply the capital.
So let's define effective altruists, because I read a lot of stuff about it, and I don't think people really get it. This is a philosophical movement that really began in was it Cambridge?
Oxford.
Oxford.
And it
migrates to Berkeley.
It grows out of utilitarianism and the general idea. I mean, we think about it as sort of
meaning
like,
maximize the benefit for the most amount of people.
That's right. And be actually mathematically rigorous about how you do your good.
You call that into question also, as did I, but we'll talk about that later.
Never mind what you think of effective altruism.
Made up numbers.
You just need to, you need to just accept this has captivated the minds of the 20 people who Sam Bankman-Fried gather to create the first Jane Street for crypto in Berkeley, California in 2017.
And these folks are literally, they set up charities, people are donating money, and they figure out, what are the biggest threats to humanity, and we'll donate money to those causes?
We'll find smart ways to donate money to those causes. That's right. And
Go out and make a ton of money give it away.
At that moment, they were pretty focused on existing human beings and saving their lives. So it was like a lot of public health in Africa, which is pretty straightforward.
Sure.
The movement was about to jump the shark and focus on future humans who'd never been born by preventing existential catastrophe, so they stop giving money for bed nets to prevent malaria in Africa, and they start giving money to Anthropic, or whatever, to AI, people who are thinking about AI risk. So it becomes a more complicated thing. In any case, they have appetite for virtually unlimited dollars. Sam is making a pitch to his fellow effective altruists. This is a market in which we can make unlimited dollars. Almost none of them have a financial background. All of them are kind of under 30. Some of them are basically 20. And they gather together, and it works for a bit, like weeks. For a few weeks, they're able to do some trades that make, I think $500,000 a day kind of thing. They were doing pretty well. But very quickly, Sam has created his semi-chaotic environment in which only he can operate and stay sane. And he's driven everybody else bad. And half of the people there's a management committee of five people, and the other four think he is either insane or criminal or both. And because they don't even know where the money is. Like, it's out.
Plus, at this point, they go from winning to losing.
They go from winning, the trades start to go bad, or it looks like they go bad. And some of they don't have a record of some meaningful number of trades.
Which is a little foreshadowing in the book that.
Oh, my God.
That. We'll talk about this. There's no record keeping. There's no CFO. There's none of the normal controls.
None of the normal controls. And Sam has created this algorithmic trading bot. He called it model bot. That he wants. It's like release the Kraken. He wants to release in the markets and make 250,000 trades a day.
They're horrified. Just going to crash and burn.
Well, they have been given $175 million from fellow rich effective altruists. And they're thinking, we're supposed to be making money to give away, and we're losing effective altruist dollars.
Right.
And everybody gets upset. And there comes a moment where they realize that actually $4 million of Ripple, XRP is the token, but of Ripple, is missing. And they just literally, they can't
How
find
much?
$4 million. For them, it was a lot.
All right.
But it's like gone. Like we don't know where it went, and how much more is gone. And Sam's attitude is, don't worry, let's keep trading because markets are only going to be good for so long, and Jane Street's going to come out and wipe us out. And so their attitude is, no, we need to stop trading and find the ripple. And this becomes a war. In the end, all the rest of the management team quits, takes big severance packages and quits. Half the firm leaves. I interviewed all these people. And if you interview them now, one of them will say, I still think he's kind of crooked. The others say we overreacted. But in any case, the punchline was, it is total chaos. They were probably right. They were huge risk. He created his environment in which he flourished. But once they leave, they find the money. It's there. The ripple is on some South Korean exchange, and the South Korean exchange is bewildered that no one
How
has
come
called.
No one's come?
We found the
Which
dudes.
Is a theme that keeps repeating
keeps
later
repeating
on.
Itself.
Like, hey, is this your $150 million?
That's right. And so that was a moment where you had a foreshadowing of what might happen later in Alameda Research. But it finds its footing, and it's kind of fine. It does well for the next...
The next day, after everybody leaves, he releases the Kraken.
He releases the Kraken, and it
works.
And
it starts killing. It's making a ton of money.
It does well. Yes, it does well.
When does he come to realize, hey, some of the other players are coming in and these big fat arbitrage opportunities are going away.
So he was the one who made markets. He was the one who everybody noticed in crypto. What just happened to the spreads? Oh my God, like something just happened. It all of a sudden started to look like a real Wall Street market. And it took a while for people to figure out that there was this wholly anonymous operation called Alameda Research with this vegan 26-year-old who was behind it. So it's about a, what is it, about a 9 months where Sam and Alameda starts to realize they have a lot of competition, and this, and it is not, the markets will never be as fat as they were. It's going to be more complicated. And they start thinking about other ways to make money. And
that's the genesis of FTX.
So FTX, it's important to know that this is how FTX comes about. And it's also important to know that they didn't think they had the capacity to actually run an exchange. Running an exchange meant having customers. It meant dealing with ordinary people.
That was the big issue. How are we going to get people
People aren't going to, I don't know how to talk to people. I don't know what people feel. How on earth am I going to be like a carnival barker at the middle of an exchange? So he knew he had the ability to create the software.
His CTO, brilliant guy.
Gary Wang.
Basically, one guy writes all the code better than everybody else that's
out
there.
Yes, which apparently didn't take much, but was true. And their thinking is, we'll get people who understand people to do this for us. They went to all the other exchanges and said, we'll sell you this and we'll keep a kind of licensing fee, but we don't want to run it. And nobody wanted it. And so they get that all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, if we're going to do this, we got to do it ourselves. So they really back into creating an exchange. He really had severe doubts about whether he was going to be able to pull this
off. That's interesting. There are two things that really leapt out about the launch of FTX. The first is all these other exchanges sort of socialized losses. So you're doing futures trading, and every customer effectively is putting up money. And if somebody has a big loss and it drops way below the collateral they put up, that loss gets spread out. So his brilliant idea is, hey, we'll have tight stops. If someone loses money, we liquidate the collateral. They're done. We're not going to have losses here.
That's right. They built a better risk engine. This is funny given what happened, but yes.
The futures trading, yes. That risk engine was very professional and well done.
That's right. And it was this chief, there were other selling points, but it was probably the chief selling point was all you crypto traders have now had the misery of socialized losses on all these exchanges, and you've just lived with it. You know, you get these clawbacks of 40 and 50% of your trades because somebody blew up, and we're not going to have that. And that is what they were selling. But problem with Sam is he never sold anything.
Right.
If you think about his background, not only is he entirely isolated as a child, when he gets to Jane Street, he's in a culture where it's just regarded as the most foolish thing in the world to say anything to anyone about what you do. They are phobic about media attention. Uh-huh. It's all bad. And it's their attitude towards the world is suck information out of it. Don't put information into it. But you can't sell that way. You have to go out and present yourself to people. And this is the big moment in Sam Bankman-Fried's life when all of a sudden he realizes that I have to be a character, or I have to be a person out there. And
so he starts going to conferences, and he's the guy that was scalping all that cash, and suddenly he kind of becomes a bit of a star.
Well, Bloomberg launches him.
The first TV show, right?
That's right. In the place that launches him. That he goes on TV. He is, by my lights, very awkward on TV.
Right. I mean, playing he's playing a video game while he's on live TV.
He's on live TV at his computer monitor playing a video game at the same time. You can see his eyes going back and forth.
Right.
You can see him not half listening to the questions he's being asked. He always says, that's a really good question.
Right. He
gave himself a little beat. He gives a little soliloquy in response to every question, but he doesn't seem guarded in any way. He seems completely open and is probably much more open. And although he's a little jittery, right? His knee is bouncing up and down.
Jackhammering.
Yeah, but it works. It's like the person who his PR person. She'd never done PR before. They'd hired
Natalie.
Natalie Tien said she looked at Sam. She said, you know, when people meet Sam, they sense his vulnerability. They're really interested in what comes out of his mouth. They see he's odd. But they kind of like his oddness. I'm just going to see if that oddness works on TV. And it did. I mean, it just did. And so all.
So he goes from there to every major crypto exchange, and suddenly every major crypto conference in Asia, they're located in Hong Kong.
Well, suddenly they start to get volume.
Right. And money starts to flow to FTX.
And if you look at the way people have made money in crypto, there are like two basic strategies. You bought Bitcoin at zero, or you bought it low and it went way up, or you created an exchange. The exchanges have been the sources of great fortunes. And it's such a simple, easy business if you manage the risk, right?
Right.
It's like you take a
you're VIG. The casino.
You're the casino. That's right. Instead of getting your money by playing games with better odds against your customers, you're just taking a slice of each transaction. But you're the casino. And FTX appealed because of where Sam came from and because of the way it was designed, immediately to big institutional trading, which was coming in, the jump tradings, the tower researches. So you started to have volume there. It was slower to appeal to the retail people who the institutional people want to interact with, but it was the fastest growing exchange. And
to put some flesh on those bones, 2 bips they were earning on $250 billion a month, which meant they're doing a few billion dollars in revenue and $400 million in profits.
It ended up being, I think, in 2021, it's a billion in revenues, and I have about $400 million in profits.
That's
so
just huge.
You've got this business. It's a really simple business that is growing so fast. And if you're looking at it as like, what might happen to this business? It seems to be poised. It's only, 8% of the marketplace to grow to be 20 or 30% of the marketplace. The marketplace end of 2021 is $2 or $3 trillion, but who knows? It's a tulip.
People were talking about $100 trillion.
Yes, that's
crazy.
Right. So this business is going to be in direct proportion to that. But there's this other thing. It is a different financial structure. This exchange, it is for a start, it custodies the customer's money. But secondly, it doesn't require any intermediaries. You trade directly on the exchange, and
right.
you don't go through a broker. You don't have any high frequency trader between you and the marketplace. The exchange isn't selling your data. What if this model finds its way into the ordinary financial markets? What if they can trade stock futures? What if they can trade commodities? Venture capitalists look at this and thought, "My God, this is a $1 trillion company if it goes right." When he starts to interact, when he starts to get big time venture capital money, he starts to get normalized. It starts to become something different than an ordinary crypto exchange.
Really, really intriguing.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You go on 60 Minutes, as you have for some of your recent books.
Yep.
I thought the interview Track the Book which I had literally just finished that day,
right.
Very closely.
Hard to do in 26 minutes a whole book, but yes. They,
so yeah, two segments. Right. Most people only get one segment. What was your experience like with 60 Minutes and some of the backlash to the interview?
Well, backlash was anticipated. I mean,
really? I did not anticipate that. I read the book and thought, this is a fun romp in a crazy part of the world.
Well, that's what will happen eventually. People will read the book. But this is how I think about it. I think I said this on 60 Minutes, that we're now in kind of a story war. What is the story of Sam Bankman-Fried? Lots of people who didn't know very much about him or it have told lots of stories with great conviction. Twitter lynched him right away without thinking very much about
why. We had a dinner, last December with a number of people who were very interested in the space.
Right.
And you kept saying, whatever you think, it's more 10 times crazier than you imagine.
It's crazier than you imagine and more complicated and more fun, actually.
And that turned out to be a fair description.
But the story war now is going to be a very loud story that comes out of the prosecution and a story that probably presented in a more muted way from the defense. Mm-hmm. And I don't think either of those stories are going to be very good or full or complete. They're not going to be nearly what I have just from having been a fly on the wall for a year and a half. And I know what I think, I know what I experienced and what it felt like, the spirit in which things were done, what this guy, as best as possible, who this guy is and how he behaves and how he thinks. Interviewed all around him, interviewed all his colleagues before they all got hauled off by the Department of Justice. And so I had a peculiar, privileged view of it, right? The prosecutors haven't spoken to Sam.
Did they speak to you?
They asked for the book. But they didn't speak to me.
Well, when did you give them the book?
We didn't give them the book. So they've got it now.
Say, go to Amazon. Go buy your own.
Kind of. And
that's interesting.
And the defense can't talk to Caroline or Gary or Nishat or a whole bunch of other people.
They're witnesses.
And I still have been able to talk to a lot of the witnesses.
Huh.
So not all of them, but a lot of them. And so I've got like unusual 360 view of the whole thing. And it was such an amazing just story. I thought, I'm just going to tell a story. And the radical act is to withhold judgment. Like, innocent until proven guilty. But leave that to one side.
Right.
There's just this story. And all the books, when they work. I have this experience with every book. 10 different readers will read 10 different books.
We have discussed this. The book you write is not the book people read.
That's exactly right. They come to it with their baggage and they walk into the hole in the book. And this came with a ready-made hole.
Right.
You're the good guy
or bad guy.
You're the juror. You get to decide. It's you. You decide. And I can tell you that I have had the most radical range of responses to the book and to the characters.
More than any book you've ever written.
More than any book I've ever written. And it's a mistake to think that I had some ambition. Some ambition to affect like the trial outcome. That's preposterous. The trial is going to be the trial. But I did want to force the reader to grapple with how they felt about this situation once they'd seen the situation in full, and that seems to offend people who have already just made up their mind about him.
Well, once you make your mind up, you know it's very hard to walk it back. You dedicate the book to your daughter in memory of Dixie Lee Lewis. You Remain Inside of Me. Tell us about that, because I recall after your daughter's accident, you kind of described yourself as, I don't know if I'm ever writing again.
Yeah, that was true. I had a very specific response. It was a tiny sliver of my response to her death. You know, I adored her, and she was the best kid. Brave and full of love and just the best kid. And I thought up to that point in my life that I was that was the luckiest person I knew. Nothing bad really had ever happened to me. I hadn't had that kind of experience. And I'd also thought that kind of the trick about, I think of writing as a kind of trick. It's like, I don't know where it comes from. I can do this thing. I don't know why. But I've always associated it with joy and pleasure and a kind of happiness. And I wondered whether I'd feel that again when I sat down before a blank computer screen. And it was joyous to find that I did feel it. Like I didn't, that I was right back in my place with maybe a little extra thing in me when I sat down to write this thing. But before I did that, I just didn't know. I just didn't know whether, like, I was so fundamentally changed that I would never want to do this.
I very vividly, a mutual friend said, hey, you should give Michael a call. So we spoke a few months afterwards, and you said something that, you know, you're such a mensch. I was genuinely shocked at this point when you're still mourning, and you said, hey, this tragedy showed me that up until this point, how lucky I actually was. Most humans aren't wired to think that way. That's a very unusual perspective mm-hmm. to look at something that's not good and try and find the goodness in a tragedy.
So this is the way to honor her. The way to honor her is not to crumble. It's to build on it.
You call her a warrior. Is that the thinking?
She was an absolute warrior. But the way to honor her is in the spirit of improv. It's you can't say no. You can't reject this. Rejecting her death, or rejecting the feelings that go with it, is to deny her in some way. What I need to do is accept whatever the emotions are and build on them. And whatever I build will have a little of her in it. So this book has a little of her in it. You know what's in her about this about her in this book? It very consciously. I knew when I wrote this book, I was going to be in a war. I knew that there was a mob sentiment, and this culture is very good at whipping up mobs very fast. Twitter like exists for it.
It's an outrage machine,
and people are so sure they're right, and that mob, to get between that mob and its target, is always dangerous. And Dixie would have done it. She would put her body between a mob and had done it before, that kind of thing. Sure. And so I thought, it's going to be a little painful, but it's worth it, and it will honor her.
So when you're talking to him and thinking, this is not long after her accident, you're thinking, I'm going to go for this, and she would absolutely support this decision.
Absolutely.
Huh. That's an amazing conversation. I remember you did a podcast. It's three actors, comedians. I don't remember.
Smartless.
That's right. Yeah. And I try never to listen to people's podcasts before I go on with them. But we were doing the 25th anniversary of Liar's Poker, and I listened to that, and the last segment was 15 minutes of you discussing
Dixie.
It was just the most poignant, beautiful conversation I've ever heard from anybody experiencing loss.
So I get.
Do you recall that podcast?
I do. I don't remember what I said, but I do remember the spirit in which I said it. And in life, I have found, and this connects to this book, it connects to many of my books, that there's a richness in recognizing and really insisting on any difference between what you feel and what you're supposed to feel. And there's always pressure to feel a certain thing, like this pressure right now to hate Sam Bankman-Fried. But if you actually feel something different, hold on to that feeling and explore it. And there's great stuff in it. Great life stuff, great literary stuff. And with my grief, right after she died, I was inundated with correspondence, very well-meaning correspondence, from people who thought they'd gone through the same thing and had on the surface gone through something similar, lost a child.
Right.
And giving me advice, sending me books, you know, telling me how I was going to feel. And none of it rang true. I knew how I felt, and I knew it was different from how they thought I should feel. And I thought, that's interesting. And the books just looked like dead words on the page to me. So I thought, I felt this way when Dixie was born. I felt that way about fatherhood. In the beginning, I just felt differently about my children than I was expected to feel. I didn't feel attached to them right in the beginning. It's like I had to learn to love my children. Love wasn't there in the beginning. You learn to love something, or you come to love something, by taking care of it, at least in my experience. And I hadn't taken care of them. Was I taking care of them? I loved them. I felt with the grief, for example, a lot of people told me I would feel guilty. And I thought, what? Why would I? I didn't feel guilty.
Survivor's guilt, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't feel guilty. I thought she had a fantastic life. We had a fantastic relationship. We had magical amounts of time together. That she was on her way to a brilliant future. I feel sad. but I don't feel guilty. I don't feel anger. I didn't feel any of the toxic emotions. I felt sad. And sad is that you can work with sad. Sad and funny. This book I've just written is sad and funny. There's so much funny stuff in it, but it's a sad story. They go together. These emotions. You're in an emotional space rather than a kind of angry. You're in a rich emotional space rather than a kind of cheap emotional space.
Huh. That's really fascinating and unexpected take. Let's bring this back to the crew of 20-somethings running FTX. I read the book not so much as in a defense of where FTX went off the rails, but just an explanation. Here are people with no experience in finance, no experience in management, no organizational structure, none of the usual controls in place to run a few million dollars, much less hundreds of billions of dollars. How criminal was this, or was this really just terrible management run amok? Was there any criminal intent?
That's the question at the heart of the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, clearly there was commingling of funds.
I'm going to answer this. Oh, yeah. Clearly, it's all in there, right? It's all bad. There's no happy story to explain it all. But I want to say this. I don't want to answer the question because I've left the question for the reader to answer. I intentionally didn't answer the question because I didn't want my thumb on the scale. So I don't really want to answer this in interviews. Let me also add to that, that it's quite possible that stuff will come out in the trial that has not come out yet that will change my views. So I don't know. I'm withholding judgment.
So let me pull something from the book that I thought was really fascinating and I think Twitter has gotten wrong. It wasn't that FTX transferred money to Alameda, transferred $8.3 billion. As I read it, FTX was unbanked. You could give them crypto, but you couldn't give them cash. Alameda had a pre-existing bank account, so you could wire money into Alameda, and then they're supposed to move it over to FTX. Is that a fair statement?
That's how 8 of the 10-something billion that got into Alameda from FTX got in.
And at one point in time, Alameda's sitting on, like, I don't know, $90, $100 billion worth of assets. It's not that $8 billion is a rounding error, but in the grand scheme of things, we'll make that mark to accounting eventually.
So that would be the story Sam would tell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the way you would challenge that story, and I do, is we were really sitting on $90 billion of assets. That was Solana and FTT and Serum. And what is it worth? You know, yes, the market seems to say it's worth that, but it's not.
You couldn't liquidate it.
You couldn't liquidate it, right? The second thing is, it's just like, unless you know Sam Bankman-Fried and know what he did back when he was trading the Ripple in Berkeley, that it seems preposterous that someone could not pay attention to $8 billion of other people's money that was in the wrong place. And that the minute they have bank accounts, or for that matter, you know, wallets to store crypto in FTX, because the dollars are going to become crypto, that you move it over. So
one would think,
It's inexcusable that it was there, but it does seem that it got, and how much difference it makes how it got there, I'm not clear. May not make any difference at all legally. But that appears to be how it got there.
Alameda, yeah, from the client, not from FTX.
Right.
Sounds like that's an important distinction.
It may be.
It's problematic.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Whether that amounts to fraudulent intent is for the jury to decide.
That's right. That's going to be the interesting thing. This is why you need to understand Sam Bankman-Fried if you're the jury. It's like, what would that mind have intended? And that's what they will decide. His odds are not good.
So you mentioned FTT, which is the coin. This story was really, this part of the narrative was really fascinating because I was unaware of this. So FTX issues FTT, which is effectively like equity in FTX.
Yes.
And they don't...
it's got a claim on the revenues.
Right? So literally profit distributions go out to FTT holders.
In the form of buybacks.
So in the form of buybacks of FTT. Right. So that's how you get paid on that. Right. That suddenly, and he does it at like pennies, not a whole lot of money. Suddenly this runs up in price.
Right.
At what point, what is FTX holdings of FTT worth?
So as long as FTX is functioning and profitable,
right,
the FTT is actually pretty liquid and valuable. The minute FTX goes down, it's worth zero.
Right.
So it's all correlated.
It's a
all
going
the same.
Concern,
and in fact,
sort of.
Pretty much everything in, well, not everything, but a lot that was in Alameda was simply one thing, Sam. FTX, FTT, Solana even, and Serum, these other tokens were so associated with him,
right,
that if FTX went down, they were all going to go down. There are parts of the story. It's funny, when I think back of like former financial scandals,
mm-hmm,
Madoff is not the analogy.
So you've said this, and I have another question, so let me bring it up here. Madoff had a legitimate business. He was the largest market maker on the NASDAQ.
Oh, way back when.
Way back when. And the problem is nobody really knows when his business turned into a Ponzi scheme.
Right, right.
There have been multiple books. None of them have found that information.
Right.
Here it's pretty clear from the beginning. No controls, commingling of funds.
Yeah, but FTX itself was never looked like,
right,
the end of
it. It was a legitimate business making a lot of money.
Right. But this thing rhymes to me with both Michael Milken and with long-term capital management. Long-term capital management didn't realize that all of its stuff was correlated because it owned it. And it,
right,
once people started going after their positions and knew their positions, even if it was, you know, a position in Russian government bonds and over here are a position in gold, it didn't matter because everybody knew they were weak and these positions were going to be puked out. And so the collapse of Sam's world reminded me a little of that. And it reminded me a little of part.
Wait, well, stay there before you move on.
Yeah.
So you talk about CZ,
right,
basically starting a run on the bank or a run on FTX because he starts saying, hey, our FTT, we've sold and we have other things. We're no longer trusting FTX as an exchange. Did he precipitate the entire collapse?
He couldn't have done it. It's a combination of him and the moment in which he says what he says.
Uh-huh.
And there's a reason I think he says what he says. He's even kind of hinted at this reason. Sam, idiotically, had made a trip to Dubai like a week earlier.
Right.
Met with Anthony Scaramucci. I was actually invited on this trip. I didn't go. But he tried to persuade the Dubai regulators to throw Binance and CZ out of Dubai.
Really?
And
they have an ongoing relationship, both Sam and yeah, Binance and Dubai and Binance.
Yes. And, you know, Binance needs to find a home. Dubai has given them a home. CZ needs to find a home. Dubai has given him a home. And so Sam was basically trying to render CZ stateless. And
Wildly
overplayed his hand. That it was just a dumb thing to do. I mean, it gets to Sam. But if he thought he was vulnerable,
mm-hmm,
why would he have done that? So maybe he didn't think he was vulnerable.
Right.
That moment argues that Sam is oblivious at that moment to how weak his hand is, because you don't do it if your hand is
right
that weak. I mean, it's really not going to get you very much.
What were you talking earlier? You go up against the king, you better kill him.
Best not miss. And the other thing is Sam was potentially disruptive to U.S. financial structure. That he was arguing, he was making an argument that was similar to Brad Katsuyama's argument in Flash Boys. A lot of unnecessary intermediation in the markets. And there's a much simpler way to do this. The structures are being built in crypto that could be ported into the U.S. stock market, where all of a sudden, you know, the exchange isn't selling customer data for business. That offended and bothered a lot of existing players.
So you talk about this specifically towards the end of the book. The takeaway from FTX and crypto is the reason this collapsed, the reason crypto had another crypto winter, is there is no banker of last resort to step up, and that it turns out capitalism needs guardrails, banks need regulations, and guess what? We all need intermediaries because the supposedly trustless system works much worse than the system that is highly regulated and supervised.
Yes, it's a great irony to me of crypto that it starts out with Satoshi's paper And Satoshi is clearly obsessed with not wanting to have to trust governments and banks. The whole point of this is this is a way to eliminate banks and governments from the monetary system, and it's a trustless system. It's peer, you trade directly with someone else, and the transactions are irreversible, et cetera, et cetera. And that he must be, if he's alive, if he's dead, he's rolling in his grave. Because what happens next? Crypto goes and invents a whole nother financial system that looks an awful lot like the existing financial system, except without regulators.
Right.
Right. And it's, and, or deposit insurance. Right. And it's, and
which turns out to be a good thing, deposit insurance.
Oh my God.
Right.
Yeah, and so, and regulators too. So who would have thought, I wouldn't have thought, that crypto would end up in this place. It would end up with all the same exchanges and brokers and banks that the financial system has. Turns out there are reasons for these things.
So let's talk a little bit about the bankruptcy and the trustees and what so far has been recovered. You write in the book, there's $8.3 billion missing.
So there's $8.6 billion in customer deposits. This is all from the bankruptcy people.
That's unaccounted for.
That the customers are still owed,
okay,
including me,
right.
My 200 grand.
And most of the employees had all their net worth tied up. These people drank the Kool-Aid. They thought this was the next great thing.
They're employees who had their whole families, and had their parents, had their brothers and sisters in with their assets on FTX. Yes.
Right. So 8.6 is owed.
Yeah. And they've said they found this is 3 months ago, and they said they were still finding it, $7.3 billion of liquid assets.
Of liquid. And in the book, you talk about other exchanges saying, hey, we have $300 million of your Ethereum here. Come get it.
When the thing is unraveling, people, not Sam, probably Sam too, but people, not Sam, are getting phone calls from banks saying, we have $300 million of dollars in an account. Do you know? And they didn't know about it.
Right.
I mean,
then you talk about the Dragon's Lair, which is all these assets. So he bought $100 million of Twitter a year before Musk buys it at like $20 a share. So right. This is a ton of money.
You know, the elephant in the room is, and it's a really interesting elephant. So Sam Bankman-Fried, one of his obsessions is artificial intelligence and making sure artificial intelligence doesn't slip its leash and eat us all, right? And this is before it's fashionable at all to think about this. Now, way back when nobody was thinking about it, or really few people. And he buys a stake in a company called Anthropic. He buys it, I think at the time, it was a 20% stake. I can't remember exactly.
I think it was $400 million?
That's something like that.
Some huge amount of money.
Huge amount of money. And when the bankruptcy happens, the guy who's running the bankruptcy, John Ray, said to me, as an illustration of the idiocy of Sam Bankman-Fried, said to me, can you believe he put like $400 million into this thing called Anthropic, and it's just air? It's just an idea. There's nothing there. Well, last week, Amazon has announced they're making up to $4 billion investment, and it's a minority stake. So this company is now being valued at least $8 billion, more probably, and it seems like it's going to the moon.
So that means his $400 million is a 3 or a 5X.
Yes, and that's right. And
so it very much looks like—
they may get paid back.
Not only they may get paid back, but the implication is, hey, if they had accounting and a CFO where— is it possible that they were never truly insolvent? If you take all their assets and add them up, might they not have needed to go into bankruptcy if there was an adult in the room running the place?
Well, if there's an adult in the room running the place, the money would never have been in the wrong place. But it's I think that's certainly true of FTX US.
Mm-hmm.
That
was tiny compared to the big one.
It's hard to know. It'll be after the fact we will find
out. But it's a real— this isn't like a one in a billion possibility.
No.
This is a realistic chance.
I think.
And I picked that number on purpose because you know why.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's right. And I think, you know, one way to think about this is you talk to the people who were trading the claims on. If I wanted to sell my claim on my deposits, I could. And I think I get like 35 cents on the dollar. Not much, but some.
Right.
It's not zero, not two.
And that's not atypical.
That's not atypical. But if you talk to the people who buy those, I had a couple tell me, we think it's maybe we can make it get 100 cents on the dollar.
Wow.
And but it, the problem is it's going
to
take
what did Madoff end up? It was pretty close to 100 cents,
was it,
wasn't
really?
It? Yeah, I think they clawed back a lot.
Well, so but this is without clawbacks. Right. So the interesting thing about this is I don't think, I mean, some people like politicians, people are embarrassed to have taken Sam's money and can give it back, have given some of it back. It's pretty peanuts that. But there are rules about clawbacks in bankruptcy.
Right.
You have to demonstrate that when the money was given, that the...
It was the proceeds of a crime.
Also that it was insolvent. And it's unclear when FTX becomes insolvent. Is it November of last year? Is it June? It certainly wasn't January of last year. They were fine. So anything that went out the door before then, you're not going to be able to claw back.
With Madoff, it was pretty easy. There was never...
Right.
You know, the last 20 years, there was no business
That's
there.
Right.
Whatever you got, you were getting somebody else's money.
That's,
so that was easy.
This is
a little more,
very
little
different,
more
and they have not made the argument yet. And tellingly, if it turns out that the money is there, it will be because the assets add up to the liabilities. That nobody's really gone systematically through this pile of stuff, an incredible pile of stuff that Sam Bankman-Fried accumulated. It's 100 and something private investments.
You call it the dragon's lair. He threw $5 billion into 300 separate entities, and many of these are giant winners.
You know,
some of his zeros,
it's a VC portfolio.
Yeah.
And the question is, what's it worth? And I don't know what it's worth. Is it enough to close the gap between 8.6 and 7.3? It seems so. There's some other, they owe some other stuff, but the customer, it'll be interesting to see what the customers get back.
So one other thing I have to ask about is you throw some shade at some of the big law firms, Sullivan and Cromwell and others. First, Sullivan and Cromwell was... for a while, FTX's outside counsel for certain things.
Including their dealings with the regulators.
Which kind of raises questions, how could they be bankruptcy counsel?
I don't understand it. Because they're sitting on
Isn't that an inherent conflict of interest?
They're sitting on the evidence for the trial. So I would have thought, that at least people would raise questions about the lawyers for FTX being also the lawyers for the bankruptcy, and also, especially since they're the ones who really twisted Sam's arm to sign the bankruptcy documents.
Right.
And
there was a typo I found in the book. You wrote that the bankruptcy lawyers are going to generate fees of $1 billion. That's a typo. What's that number supposed to be?
It's not a typo.
It's $1 billion in lawyer fees.
There are hundreds of advisor, lawyer and other fees.
Real.
Lawyer and other fees. So this is where we are. We're at several hundred million now.
Uh-huh.
One of the creditors, big creditor, did an analysis of what they were going to charge by the time the dust settles, and they figured out it's going to be about $1 billion.
That's unconscionable.
The thing that's striking to me is just how insider a game the bankruptcy process is.
For a long time now, too.
But it used to be regulated by the SEC.
And
in the 80s, they took it out of the SEC,
uh-huh.
and they created this thing called a bankruptcy trustee who's in the Department of Justice, but has no real power except the power to bitch and moan to the
right.
bankruptcy judge.
Right, he could petition, but he's got no
and
authority.
And so he did in this case. He said, this is outrageous. They shouldn't be. The Department of Justice guy wrote a long letter saying you should not allow Sullivan and Cromwell to be the bankruptcy lawyers, and they should.
So
also,
this isn't Michael Lewis whining at
at
any. This is basically DOJ saying these are the wrong attorneys,
but
here.
They don't have the power to do anything about it. And
did the SEC back in the day?
Yeah, yeah. So huh. it's changed so that the power resides with the bankruptcy judge, and the bankruptcy judge is usually a former bankruptcy lawyer, and it just starts to smell like a club. And what with all the trustee was asking for is there needs to be like an outside examiner to watch this stuff. And the judge wouldn't even allow that. So this thing is happening essentially inside of a black box. And I just find that curious. It just seems like, how could that be?
How could it be? So I have hundreds of questions more for you, but I'm going to just stick to the two most potent ones. Now, effective altruism seemed like a big part of Sam's persona and his self-identification. I came away from the book thinking this is a bunch of nonsense. I mean, seriously, they talk about, well, the risk from a supernova is 1 in 1 billion and an asteroid is 1 in 1 million and a pandemic is 1 in 100 and AI is 1 in 30. And these are just BS made-up numbers, which— you know, to a math guy, even a middling MIT math guy, should have been like obvious red flags that this is crap. How did they get away fooling so many smart people? Or am I overstating this?
I said the same thing.
I immediately... So, but by the way, if you just sit down for 2 minutes with a pen and paper, the one in a billion on the supernova, you could show us something like 1 in 4 trillion very, very easily. And I'm sure... But it doesn't matter. They're just round, made-up numbers.
So in their heads, you got to understand this is a psychological as much of an as an intellectual movement, right? It's tribal. They're finding solace in each other's company. They're loving having these arguments about this thing. And what would they say? Let me see if I can defend it for just a moment. There's some number that's true, whatever it is. We don't may not know the number, but there's some number that's true. And if any number is true and you multiply it by an infinite future, you get a big number.
Yes and no. I mean, for a guy who specializes in probabilities.
I tried.
Hey, listen, eventually the universe suffers from heat death and entropy means that everything dies. Yeah, yeah. So why bother doing your homework?
I tried.
Right.
I just tried. I'll stop now. I didn't try to do much in the way of defending this.
No, I was completely simpatico with you as I'm reading, and I'm turning my nose up. And so, then you throw the numbers out and say this is nonsense.
Let me offer another kind of weird defense of them and that. It's pretty cool how quickly they got to threats from artificial intelligence.
Right.
And
that's fair.
When nobody cared about it.
Right.
And now everybody
And a pandemic before COVID.
Yeah. That's right.
So I'll give them credit
some credit for paying attention to things. These things are not unimportant. Once you start to kind of turn mathy about them, it starts to feel a little silly.
Yeah.
And especially when you devote your life to these equations, then it seems to sit like a little just off. But it wasn't just stupid. It was 4.0 stupid. It was, you know what that is? It's sort of like the kid on the softball
team.
Weapons
grade stupid.
Yeah, it's like the kid on the softball team who's the best student but doesn't know when to steal a base. And it's a little of that. It's like blind spots to the intelligence is what it felt like. Like really smart people with this big blind spot.
Last question. So I've read your whole body of work, some books multiple times. And we talked a little bit about Flash Boys. But the thing that kind of stood out to me is wondering... Regarding the characters in this book, do you find any similarities between the world of crypto and the world of subprime mortgage securitization? Any parallels there?
You know, there probably are. That's not what popped into my mind. What popped into my mind when I was working on the book, the nature of the characters and kind of how outrageous it all was and how there were no guardrails was Liar's Poker. I just felt like I'm back in a space where your jaw is on the floor because of what's going on, and you can't believe this happens in a business. That was the feeling about Liar's Poker. Wait, this is an actual business, and strippers are on the floor and all that stuff. And then it quickly got very straight-laced on the surface. This is the moment in crypto before it gets straight-laced. And it reminded me of that. Different people, you know, they're more nerds than jocks, but still wacky, like just wacky behavior. And the wackiness was kind of joyous. It was like there's a range of behavior is being tolerated here that's not ordinarily tolerated in commercial and financial life.
Right. This was more frat house than trading floor.
Yes, a nerd frat house, but yes.
Michael, thank you for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with the one and only Michael Lewis discussing his brand new book, Going Infinite, The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon. If you enjoy this podcast, well, be sure and check out any of the previous 500 we've done over the past 9 years. You can find those at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, or Bloomberg.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. Follow all the Bloomberg family of podcasts at Podcast. Check out my daily reads at Ritholtz.com. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team who helps put these podcasts together each week. My audio engineer is Meredith Frank. Atika Valbron is my project manager. Anna Luke is my producer. Sean Russo is my researcher. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated. Member SIPC and NYSE.